This is the Friday Show on KLCC. I'm Rachel McDonald. We're here with Lane County Senior Public Health Officer, Dr. Patrick Ludke. Hi, Dr. Ludke.
Hello, Rachel. Happy Friday to you and the listeners.
Thank you. So the state and Lane County are seeing a surge in cases of COVID-19, and the pause in the use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine means a reduction of supplies of vaccine. Meanwhile, the state is opening up eligibility to all Oregonians 16 and older next week. So can you share your assessment of where things stand here in Lane County?
Well, those are two challenges. Absolutely. You hit both of them right on the head. We had a trough in number of new cases in Lane County for several weeks throughout March, and then it just started going up. And I think, as I mentioned on past shows, we expected a bit of an increase after spring break and after we opened up some schools, but the increase is pretty significant. So even just day over day from yesterday to today, 74 new cases in 24 hours, that's just too many. It's not as bad as it was November, December, where we were getting, you know, closer to 100, but gosh, we're getting close to that. So that is an absolute challenge, and we had been very hopeful that this vaccine pipeline would fill more and more and more and more. So we are fortunate to have more Pfizer doses, more Moderna doses, but we were kind of counting on more doses from J&J and then eventually the other vaccines to arrive, and that's going to be put off for some time. So we're still in a time frame where there's disease out there, we don't have enough people immune, and we're going to be challenged for the weeks to come.
At a press briefing today, Governor Kate Brown spoke about inequities in vaccine distribution and how the state is trying to address them. What is Lane County doing to make sure vaccines are getting to people of color and those who are low income?
Oh, gosh, we're doing a lot. I really appreciate that question. So I suspect many people who listen or watch the news, they think that these mass vaccination events are occurring and probably not much else. So it is true we have these big events at Autzen Stadium, the Lane Event Center, Lane Community College, where thousands of people are getting vaccinated each weekend. But we also have these mobile groups going out all over the place, literally. So just in the last few weeks, we have had events with the NAACP. We've had events with Huerto de la Familia, with LULAC. It's another Latinx group. We had events with Latino, Central Latino Americano, and then we also have these mobile groups that are going out to Cottage Grove and up the McKenzie River to where the fire victims are putting their lives back together, Leeburg and Blue River, and also several events in Florence. So we are really not just static, but we're mobile too. So we're doing all we can to reach multiple groups. And I'll add one more piece to that. Working with some of those CBOs, we call those community organizations, and working with those groups, we asked them, so where is it that you feel we can best reach Black and African American persons? Where is it you feel we can best reach Hispanic and Latinx? And that may be a specific church, it might be a parking lot, it might be some other event, and that's where we're going. So we're doing a lot, Rachel.
What about vaccine hesitancy? Is that something you've been observing just in general, and how are you addressing it?
You know, vaccine hesitancy is a growing problem in this country, and I guess I've been in this field long enough to remember when almost everybody got vaccinated if the doc or the nurse practitioner said get vaccinated. And, you know, that started to change about 20 years ago, and it seems more and more people are questioning the value of vaccine, and we could probably have a whole show on vaccine hesitancy, but I view it, I think there's two big pieces to this, and this is my personal view, sort of distilling the research. I think there are a variety of reasons people choose not to vaccinate. I think two of them, public health and the clinical community, absolutely have to own, and those are, first of all, many people don't know that certain bacteria or viruses exist. Now, I think most people know COVID is out there. Some people may question how severe it is for them. But for other vaccines, people just kind of wonder, gosh, we haven't had a polio case in decades, or measles doesn't happen often. So we really need to let people know it's only a plane flight away. You should be protected in case it shows up. And then also one that we should own is that many people don't know that these vaccines are recommended for them or their family or their loved ones. So I think those two, the clinical community and public health, really need to own those. But the other five reasons, I think there's seven main reasons people don't choose to be vaccinated. The other five reasons are kind of part and parcel of what we are seeing in society as a whole. people are questioning most everything, it seems, these days. So they're questioning the vaccine side effects. And we saw this with J&J vaccine this week with a pause on its use. They're questioning vaccine effectiveness. They're questioning the motivation or the motives of the pharmaceutical industry, making money versus doing the right thing, so to speak. They're questioning government recommendations of all types. And then finally, just vaccine science in general. So we have had town halls on vaccine hesitancy and throughout Lane County, but not recently. I think we need to do that again. And we are trying to reach people where they're at and help them to understand the value of these vaccines to themselves, to their family, to their community in terms of the COVID vaccines. But it's a challenge sometimes. So we need to continue to communicate and operate in that space, and we are trying to do so.
This week, the city of Eugene released results of a community survey on COVID-19. One finding is that 45%, or about 4 out of every 10 residents, say they've experienced emotional distress due to COVID-19, and almost 20% have accessed mental health services for help with anxiety, stress, or depression. Now, Dr. Ludke, is this in keeping with what you've observed at the county public health level?
We have seen some of the same challenges in the behavioral health, mental health space. Now, it's a little more difficult capturing the actual data here, because it's one thing to say you have a laboratory test and it says that you have measles. That's pretty straightforward. But we don't get the same level of data reported to public health in terms of anxiety and depression. And so it's a little more difficult. So we have to pull together data sources. But we have heard from a variety of behavioral health providers in the community, whether they are psychiatrists or psychologists or social workers, that their practices are full. Many of them have waiting lists for weeks. And that doesn't happen very often unless there's a lot of behavioral health challenges in the community. So that's number one. And then number two, of course, we do manage some of the data sources that are really unequivocal. So suicide data, for example, suicide attempts, we do get some of that data. There's a little bit of heartening, encouraging data there. I think many of us had thought last year when this all began that there was going to be a big increase in suicides across our community, across the state, across the country. And we now have the 2020 data, and there was about a 20% drop in Lane County in suicides. And that really is encouraging. And that also was the same range in the state and in the country. There was a significant drop in suicides. Now, you always have to put that data into context. There was an increase in opiate overdose deaths. And maybe some of those were suicides. People don't always leave a note. You don't know whether they were pleasure-seeking or they were actually trying to kill themselves. But at least in terms of suicides, it's dropped. But in terms of people seeking care because of distress, clearly in Lane County, we are seeing an increase in that, and as evidenced by the long wait for people to get in.
Well, let's turn to some listener questions. We have a few that have to do with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and this one is an email we got from Bill, who asks, given the evidence of rare blood clots in younger women with the J&J vaccine, why not continue giving it to men and perhaps to older women?
Well, that's a good question. So the general way we move forward in this space, of course, is to get as much information as you can. And the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, and the Centers for Disease Control, they dig more deeply into the data of those six persons that were identified who had these blood clots in their brain. And so we know that they were women under age 50. We know that they had these side effects from the vaccine less than 2 weeks after the dose. But we don't know a lot more. And the reason that I think that preamble was worthwhile is because I can tell you very clearly that I've had a few patients who had a venous clot in their brain in my career in medicine. And most commonly, believe it or not, they are in younger women. So that kind of fits. So that makes you think, well, maybe it's not vaccine related. Also, it's about 1 in 1 million. Well, the Pfizer doses, we've given 6.8 million doses of this vaccine, and we have found six people who have these blood clots in their brain. That's about 1 in 1 million. So that kind of makes you wonder, is it really related to the vaccine or is it not? But many of the baseline cases in younger women non-vaccine related, occur in women who are also taking birth control pills, who also may be smoking, and both of those, smoking and birth control pills, increase the risk for blood clots. So we have to tease out that data and find out, were any of these women who got the vaccine also smoking? Were they also on birth control pills? Did they have other risks for blood clots? So that's why this review is happening, and probably a week from today there'll be a final decision about whether or not the vaccine will be allowed to go forward. If I were a betting person, I would lean towards that as being the ultimate outcome, but we will see. We need to really have science in action and assess that.
Now, Ida emailed in this question saying, many people prefer the J&J vaccine because it's one and done. How does the efficacy of one shot of Pfizer or Moderna compare to one dose of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine?
Oh, I think that's a good question. So there are a couple countries that have gone that way because of scarcity of vaccine. You know, the UK did that for several months. They had that UK variant, the 117 variant that started to spread like wildfire there, and they said, we don't have enough vaccine to wait to vaccinate everybody with two doses. So let's just give one dose and see if we can tamp things down a bit by getting some immunity. We have some data now from research trials, well-done research trials, published in good peer-reviewed medical journals, showing that the single dose for Pfizer and Moderna might be in the 60 to 80% effective range. That's pretty high. I mean, that's, you know, way better than a coin toss and certainly better than a typical influenza vaccine each year. So it could potentially be worthwhile. But we also know you get a much bigger bump. You get up to that 95% that was reported for Pfizer in their FDA submittal if you get two doses. So if we had a big shortage of vaccines, we wish we had more, absolutely. We wish J&J was there. We wish the AstraZeneca was here. But if we had a much bigger shortage than we have, I think that would be more on the table. But right now in Lane County, you know, we're getting 20,000-plus doses a week on average. Yes, we wish we had more, but it's good enough for us to proceed with the two-dose vaccine plan.
I've read that vaccine makers are already talking about the next booster shots for Pfizer and Moderna, which might be needed within a year of getting the initial dose of vaccine and then annually afterwards. What's your understanding of the latest research on this?
Well, first I would say it's way too early to say something like annually thereafterwards. We just don't know how long this immunity is going to last. We're learning literally every month as we look back at people who were vaccinated last year. They get their blood drawn. We find out they still have antibodies that are protective. They're at a protective level. So it's way too early to say that. I guess you could think about it and wonder how would it fit into my life, but we just don't have that data. The latest is that, at least the latest that I've read, and I try to read, you know, multiple studies every week, is that we still have durable immunity, and people have not dropped off at 6 to 7 months after the dose, the two doses for Pfizer and Moderna. So this is not only the presence of neutralizing antibodies, but the presence at a high enough level to prevent infection. So we only have 7 months of data for a significant number of people, starting from those phase three trials moving forward. So I think it's way too early to say we're going to make this an every year booster. It is possible, though, that it could be something akin to like the booster we do for tetanus. You know, tetanus is roughly every 10 years. We recommend you get a tetanus booster. Tetanus is a terrible disease. Thousands of people used to die from it in America every year. On the planet, there's about 50,000 deaths per year from tetanus, and, you know, it's a lot. So we need to prevent it. But it could be that this vaccine, the COVID vaccine, will require a booster every 5 years or every 10 years, but only time will tell us, Rachel, how that settles out.
You're listening to The Friday Show on KLCC. We're with Lane County Public Health's Dr. Patrick Lidke. I'm Rachel McDonald. And Dr. Lidke, we had a question emailed to us from Barb who wants to know which variants are currently present in Lane County and how well do the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines work against them?
Well, that is very timely. So we just received our first report from the University of Oregon, their genetics laboratory that is now doing this sequencing testing, which identifies variants. And we, as of, the report was dated the 14th, so this week, we just got it 2 days ago, they found 8 UK variants, so that's that 117 variant I mentioned earlier in the show, 7 variants from California, there's 2 California variants, this is the 429 variant, and then 4 variants that are called the New York variant, that's the 526 variant. So that's more than we would have liked to have seen. But they're here, and we knew that because they were spreading elsewhere in the country and because people are indeed traveling, much less than they were in 2019, but they're traveling, that those variants were going to come here, and they have. So fortunately, again, getting more and more data as we move forward in the timeline of this pandemic, we can say that those variants are still taken care of in the vaccine, which is wonderful news. So if you have already been vaccinated, you are captured, you're covered for those variants. You're not going to be at increased risk because they have mutated outside of the vaccine. There probably will be a variant sometime. Whether or not it has the ability to spread, we don't know, but there'll probably be a mutation that will be mutating outside of the protection of the vaccine. But, you know, mutations don't happen by themselves. They affect other parts of the virus, and maybe that mutation will occur, but it won't be able to spread very readily from person to person, and it'll just die out. So we can be hopeful in that space.
Okay, that's promising. Here is a voicemail question.
Hi, this is Chris in Eugene, and I'm wondering if there will be any studies of the various vaccines and statistics on the amount and type of side effects reported for each one. Thank you.
Side effects.
Yeah, so I know earlier, but maybe back in January, when we first had the published studies for the Pfizer and Moderna, there were whole pages on the classic side effects that we look at in vaccines. So there's the local side effects. You know, anytime you get a sliver or you get a needle, it hurts, right? And you have the local pain in the shoulder, and you have redness, and sometimes it's a little bit stiff. And then there's the systemic. We call, you know, part of your whole bodily system, and we call that systemic side effects. And those are the joint pains, the muscle pains, the fever. And those, that data was very well published. It's required to be published in order to have these vaccines approved. So we knew, for example, that for the Pfizer vaccine, a certain percentage of people got fever, and a certain percentage in certain age groups. If I remember correctly, Pfizer was 55 and above for those side effects, and I think for Moderna it might have been 50 was their delineator. So we absolutely know that data. And I don't have all on the tip of my tongue, but the vaccines, you know, we don't just dump these products on the market, whether it's a vaccine or a medical device or a medication, and then say, go forth and make money. We require, we being the Food and Drug Administration, the federal government, requires what we call post-marketing surveillance. The manufacturers of these vaccines, they have to surveil the patient population to find out, are these weird effects happening? And that's how we found out about these 6 blood clots with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So we absolutely are learning more. One thing we did learn that I didn't see in the initial presentation for Pfizer was that a tiny number of people who get the Pfizer vaccine have this urinary tract system pain for a short period of time. So basically it hurts to urinate, and it can be 6, 8, 10, 12 hours. Not exactly sure why. Very, very, very small numbers. But we've learned now over the last few months that in a tiny percentage of people that does happen. So we're really happy that that post-marketing surveillance occurs.
We had a question from Curtis, who emailed and asked if you recommend or not the use of zinc to lessen cold-like symptoms after, he says, the second vaccine injection. But I guess, like, in terms of lessening the effects of side effects, would zinc be recommended? And I'm going to throw in here, Dr. Ludke, because I've also heard people say drink lots of water, take vitamin D. There's all these, you know, tips on how to avoid side effects. And do you have any thoughts or advice on that?
Yeah, there is a lot of research in this area, too. So vitamin D, vitamin C, zinc, there are many different studies looking at it. And they're being broken up based on the population needs. So, for example, if you're an outpatient, that's one group of people. If you're already really sick and in the hospital, would vitamin D make a difference? So many people are vitamin D deficient. Let's just start with vitamin D. Many people are vitamin D deficient in this country, especially in the winter months. There's not a lot of sun. You need sunshine to make the active form of vitamin D. And especially here on the western side of the Cascades, you know, it can be pretty dreary in the winter months. But we haven't found smoking gun data in several studies that giving vitamin D as a supplement has made any difference. We have not seen the same improvements with vitamin C supplementation or with zinc. Now, keep that in mind. That's for COVID. There have been some past studies in respiratory infections, so enterovirus, adenovirus, rhinovirus, where zinc has made a difference when it's used a certain way. And I'm not going to endorse it because there are lots of different products on the market. Is it just a pill? Is it something that's in the liquid and you inhale it a little bit, sort of like if you were squirting saline to clear your nasal passages? There's zinc gluconate, zinc picolinate. There's several different types of zinc. So we just don't have any good studies, either inpatient or outpatient, that these products are helpful at this time.
Okay. oh, well. So here's a question that we got from Harold, another email, who says, during a recent work meeting, we discussed the idea of bringing some remote workers back into the office as long as we can stick to safety protocols. They also discussed the idea of making it mandatory to be fully vaccinated before returning to work. And he wants to know what your thoughts are about this, you know, the subject of making vaccines mandatory for businesses.
So I think this is a challenging area. So when I first moved to Oregon, I learned quickly that we have a statute on the books. And if anybody wants to look it up, I happen to know it by heart. It's the only statute I know by heart. It's ORS 433.416. And that statute basically says you cannot, for purpose of employment, mandate a vaccine that is not mandated by the federal government or by the state government. And right now, COVID vaccine isn't mandated by anybody, the state or the feds or others. So you can't, as far as I understand, and again, I'm not an attorney, you cannot mandate it for purposes of employment. And as the way we get around the challenge, for example, in a long-term care facility, people are every year at high risk for getting influenza. Wouldn't you love to have every caretaker to be vaccinated for flu so the caretaker or the nurse or the doc didn't give influenza to a very frail 90-year-old? We can't mandate that. But you can say that you can require infection control measures. So during flu season, if you're not vaccinated, well, then you have to wear a mask during your shift for the entire 8 hours. That helps keep the patient safe. So many hospitals do that, actually, during flu season. So I would say, as I understand it, you cannot mandate the vaccine for purposes of employment in Oregon. But you can mandate infection control measures that can help keep your employees and your customers safe.
Okay, we just have a minute left. I'm going to try to shoehorn this question in. This is from Eden, who wants to know about having an indoor party in June with all adults vaccinated. But it sounds like there will be kids there.
Okay, and you're not going to play it.
It's just an email that I'm paraphrasing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I am hopeful that we will be in a different place come July. June, if it's early in June, I'm still a little nervous because we've had this big increase in cases that we talked about at the top of the hour. I think that if you're going to plan it, do it outside, number one, and make sure that you are very thoughtful about where people get bunched up, where they come together. That usually is where the food is, the food table, where the beverage table is, you know, five people go to get a soda or a beer at the same time. And if you're playing games, make sure that you are thoughtful about how it is that people might get exposed, be close to each other. And then, you know, be very thoughtful as well about who's at risk and who's not. And say, look, if you're at high risk, you may not want to attend this event. We'll do it at another time where it's safe.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Ludke.
You're most welcome.
Dr. Patrick Ludke is Senior Public Health Officer with Lane County. You can find a guide to where to get a COVID-19 vaccine in our region. It's at our website, klcc.org. We had production help from Angela Kellner. I'm Rachel McDonald. Thank you for listening to the Friday show. Enjoy your weekend.